Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hi, everybody.
And we are going to answer more of your cycling and triathlon related questions today. You can submit them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast, and we will comb through them, put them into a feed, and answer as many as we can every week.
You sounded very radio-y there.
Did I?
Yeah.
I apologize if that's a bad thing. Chad, you're technically not with us when people are listening to this right now. You're technically in Italy somewhere.
In the Dolomites, most likely.
You've probably finished up your time in the Dolomites.
Oh. Yeah, okay.
Right? Yeah. Sure.
I'll take your word for it.
Whatever.
We're recording this in advance.
I'll be in Italy, so regardless.
It's going to be pretty cool. So if you're listening to this and wondering, and if you want to put us into a time and place, Chad's actually in Italy right now. So.
At the Giro d'Italia.
Yes, pretty cool stuff. Let's get straight into things this week with Peter's question. He says, hey guys, love the podcast. 4.5 stars and 5 stars for the Nate Show episodes.
Yes.
Don't encourage him, please.
I've been talking about this a lot. We should talk more about me.
Yeah, we need more of that. Good point. He says, I walk my dog every day for 1 to 1.5 hours a day. While it doesn't impact my training, does it in any way contribute to my aerobic base? My dog also loves sprint training, running, which is what I do when I'm in a pinch for time with him. Anyways, keep up the good work, guys. Love the podcast and love listening to the podcast while walking my dog.
Depends on how fast you're going. Most likely, probably not. It might in some way help you maintain some of your aerobic base, but I doubt it's enough of a stimulus to actually inspire improvements in your aerobic base. So it's not a waste of time, and it's probably beneficial in terms of the psychological benefit you derive, but I don't think you're going to get to be a faster bike rider based on going for a walk with your dog for an hour and a half a day.
Yeah, it probably does change your aerobic fitness somehow, but not in a meaningful way that you'll notice on the bike. Mm. But there is definitely going to be a caloric burn to that, which could be beneficial, and most of that will be taken from fat since you're at such a low intensity. So, and you're going to be with your dog for an hour and a half.
Exactly.
Sounds like fun.
Great way to spend an hour.
On the con side of things, because we walk our dogs for about an hour every day too. Mm-hmm. This is not, walking your dog is not recovering. So if you're in a situation where you're really pinched for time and you're doing a lot of training stress, and maybe you need to maximize your ability to recover because you're maximizing the amount of stress you can take, just remember that this is active. And I don't know if you would categorize this as, which we'll talk about at another point a little later on, but I'm not sure you would categorize this as necessarily, you know, active recovery. Maybe you would, but
I would.
Yeah, it's certainly not laying down with your feet up though is the one thing to keep in mind, right? So. Being on your feet. Chris, he says, I race cross-country marathon like the Epic Ride Series and other 50 to 100 mile endurance mountain bike events. As very much an age group racer, no podium threat am I. I'm a large rider at 225 pounds race weight. My question is this, for these events, is it worth upgrading my 4-year-old alloy cross-country full suspension frame to a newer carbon cross-country full suspension frame to save 2 or 3 pounds of frame weight for a cost of about $3,000? Will it make a difference either in my results or ride experience? I tried a hardtail to save weight and found the ride experience trade-off not to be worth the weight savings. Excellent podcast, 5+ stars, and the reason I am a year-round Trainer Road subscriber.
He must be talking about the Nate episode there.
Yeah, it must be.
This sounds like a question for Jonathan, but I think I'm gonna frame this, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. There's two questions. One is the 2 to 3 pounds saving weight, but the other is in 4 years, there's been a lot of changes in mountain bike technology and geometry that could be a bigger, more enjoyable, faster savings than the weight.
Yeah, spot on.
Please explain.
That's exactly what I would say. It was very well. I feel like I'm in T-ball right now, and he just put it right on top for me. That was
good. You're welcome.
Yeah, you're spot on. I don't think that the weight savings should be your biggest concern. I think that so carbon fiber, a lot of people always think I have an aluminum bike and if I go to carbon fiber, I'm going to get the benefit of having a light bike. But to be honest, the greater benefit that comes with most carbon frames is the fact that it's a very customizable or tunable material to build a frame out of. So you can make that frame flex in good ways at the right times and be rigid in the right ways at the right times. So you can make a bike that just handles better. And sure, it might be a little bit lighter, but weights, to be honest, especially in something like mountain biking, if we're talking about a bike, an aluminum bike that's flexy and you're constantly having to put out surges of power over a lot of stuff, there could be, you know, power loss there. If you're talking about on mountain biking specifically, a bike that handles well, that could be a huge advantage because crashing is a whole lot slower than saving a little time with weight over the course of the ride, right? So I would absolutely think that your drive or motivation in this should be just to get a better performing bicycle, not necessarily a lighter one. So
yeah. What about too the difference in the head tube angle, how slack the bike is?
Yeah, great. Yeah, the geometry's totally changed. Chad, what were you riding before? Because you just got a new bike, but were you riding?
I think it's like a 2012 Giant Trance.
Okay. And it's full suspension, right?
It was hardtail.
The Trance was.
Yeah, the Trance is a full
Trance
suspension.
Trance is full suspension. Oh, I still have a hardtail. Sold the, yeah.
Yeah, and then you just got the Yeti.
4.5.
So you've got, I think, like a 1.5 degree slacker head tube angle, which basically means that the forks are angled further out in front of you instead of tucked underneath the bike. You've got a slightly slacker head tube angle on that bike. You've got a lower bottom bracket, I think, which means that your center of gravity will be lower. But then on top of that, too, the seat tube will be angled in such a position that it's putting you, that it's when you're seated on the bike, you're not going to be too far behind. Bikes have been changing now so that everything is getting a little bit more slack. So that puts you further behind the bottom bracket when you're sitting down. But now they're kind of moving that seat tube angle back up so you can stay closer to the bars. And you've got a longer front center, which means that if you were to draw a point from your bottom bracket, the center of it, and then a line forward to where the head tube, or where the fork would be, right, on the head tube, you've got a longer front center. So that basically just means that when you're standing up and riding the bike, you have a little more room. It handles a lot better. So
This is just over the last few years.
It's crazy. It's really crazy. Over the past 3 years, and suspension design is something that's really changed in the past 3 years. It's gotten a lot better too. So, or even 2 years, really. The past 2 years, from 2015 forward, suspension made a lot of leaps. So, in terms of it being justifiable with the cost, that's always a tough thing. That's a very individual thing. But if you get a bike,
I can help with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If it's a new bike, it's justifiable.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there we are. Yeah. But I guess that the motives with this isn't necessarily weights. Carbon isn't necessarily lighter anymore. You know, Cannondale makes aluminum bikes that weigh like 12.5 pounds, I think, one of their highest end aluminum bike. They can make them plenty light. It's just you can do so much with carbon to get it to behave like you want. And in mountain biking especially, that really makes a big difference. So
he's doing cross country races and epic rides, the series. What's that like? Is that like cross country or more trail, being more technical than a cross country race?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably less technical than most like cross country Olympic races that you might have, where those are on short loops. Those short loops usually have man-made features or something that's tricky that you have to go over every lap. And a lot of these epic rides events, they'll have sections of fire road or long sections of single track. But they won't have, the chances are you won't have to do loops on some crazy kind of crowd-pleasing event, right? Or crowd-pleasing feature. So in that case, it's kind of tricky trying to decide where you want to go with a hardtail or full suspension, right?
Well, he said he didn't like the hardtail, so he wants to go full suspension. Mm-hmm. But so I have two questions for you, Jonathan. One, what kind of suspension? So cross country too, is that's going to be typically the least amount of suspension you're going to have on a bike. What kind of suspension would someone have on a cross country mountain bike?
Yeah. So in terms of how much travel you want in the front, 100 to 120 millimeters is what you usually see on a cross country bike, but 130 millimeters also isn't out of the realm of possibility. You could have, I guess 120 to 100, that's your cross country range.
Yep.
You might have 100 millimeters and back. You usually have less travel and back. As you get upward of that in terms of travel, you know, 120 up to 140, maybe even up to 150, that's a trail bike category. And those bikes could work too. They just aren't going to be as efficient for what you need on race day. So
that's what Chad and I use. Yep. A trail bike to race.
Right. And it makes, if you're going to just have one bike and you want to do long rides, maybe ride some gnarlier terrain, but also do some XC races, it's like a perfect quiver bike.
I need a new bike.
I think you do. but for this bike, or for epic ride style of racing, if you have a bike with 100 millimeters or up to 120 in the front, you'll be totally fine.
So now that my last question is, if he's at 225 pounds, pounds, and he's on the lower end of suspension, mm-hmm. does he have to do anything different? Does he have to buy a different type of shock, or should he go up to a trail bike for being, or does it not even matter?
Yeah, the one thing I would look at is, and sorry in this case, but a lot of DW link bikes, so Giant, I'm thinking of that one, Pivot, some other ones, they have a really high leverage ratio, and we're getting nerdy here, so sorry, y'all, but they have a really high leverage ratio, meaning so basically what that means is that the shock ends up having to run a ton of pressure to be able to withstand or allow you to go through the travel like you need to. Certain designs, like I'm thinking of, my Yeti ASR, it's got a really simplified, it's called a single pivot design, meaning that it has less pivots than most of the new bikes. It's very effective, especially at this type of riding, and it's light and it's simple. But the best part about it is that you don't have to run a ton of pressure in your shock. And being a heavier rider, you might find the fact that, number one, you're limited at 300 pounds of pressure that you can put into a shock in most cases. And if you're at 225 pounds and you get onto something like a Giant, one of their XC bikes, like their Anthems, you're going to have to be running upwards of, 250, maybe even up to like 280 PSI. And those shocks, even though they'll be slightly tuned for that, they still don't work as well at that close to their ceiling. They would work better at a middle ground. So that's one thing I would consider is being heavier. Look for something that like a simple single pivot design. Even something like a Specialized Epic has four bar design, it's called, but it's a pretty simple design that doesn't have a high leverage ratio either. So Santa Cruz is another one that wouldn't be too bad. So yeah, that's what I would look at.
And
Scott's new bike actually is pretty good too.
Did you name Yeti in there too?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. My bike's freaking awesome. So yeah.
I was going to say, out of all those bikes, and I know what you're going to say.
You're right.
You have a Yeti. I have a Yeti. Chad has a Yeti. But what would you recommend? Everyone just has to know that you are a Yeti fanboy.
Yeah. And I ride for Yeti. We should be clear with that.
Oh yeah. And I have a Yeti t-shirt on right now.
Yeah, he does. But I would recommend either the new Scott Spark. They redesigned that thing and the geometry looks really good on it. Really good. That's a sweet looking bike. And they also have done some really clever things with like cable routing on it. And so you have a lockout for that shock, but you don't even see the cable. It's really cleverly, well done. And that one has good geometry. You'll see with cross country bikes like the Specialized Epic, it's got a really upright head tube angle. It's kind of twitchy. It only has 100 millimeters of travel up front. It doesn't make for a very confidence inspiring ride. Yet I see so many roadies getting that bike because they just think that that's, the cross country bike they should buy because Lycra wearing mountain bikers ride something like that. But you'd be much more comfortable, especially if you are a roadie going over to that, but you'd be much more comfortable on a bike with a little more slack head tube angle, longer front center, that type of stuff. So I'd say clearly I can't recommend my bike high enough. And I know that that kind of comes at zero value since I ride for them, but it seriously is a good bike. But the new Scott Spark is really good looking too.
I believe too, it's a good data point is you love their bikes and you said, please let me ride for you. Please let me ride for you.
Yes.
They didn't find you and then do it. You first bought the bike and then say, now I need to ride for you.
I test rode a bunch of bikes and I test rode one of those and I said, this is the best bike. And I'm not a free bike type of guy hunting out for that type of stuff. I just thought I wanted to ride the best bike and that was the one I picked. And then everything happened after that. So yeah. Which touching on Epic rides really quick, you're both doing the Carson City off-road?
Yes.
Yes.
Nice.
Oh, this is one of them.
There it is.
It's a race.
There we are. They both get to line up against each other. So that one, usually Epic rides they have a 15 mile race, a 30 mile race, and a 50 mile race for amateurs. The pros just do the 50 mile race and they also have a fat tire criterium in like an urban downtown area, which is really fun and really terrifying with wide handlebars. But you can't move through the pack with that. But for us amateurs, are all three of us, we're all doing the 50 miler, right?
Yep.
And then usually it's just one big loop, all of these ones. And this year we're kind of breaking news here on this one, but I don't think they're going to be able to do the big loop. I have this on good authority because they have like 16-foot snow drifts across the top of the course that they usually take. And those are not going to go away in time. So they're going to be doing shorter laps and much more single track than Fire Road. Last year it was like an hour and 30 or 40 minute climb, just a long drag way up high. And this year it's a lot shorter climb. And then we just do, I think, like three laps maybe. So It's going to be interesting to see.
This will be a great way for me to judge myself against, like, a measuring stick against Chad, because we have the exact same bike.
Yes,
and
true.
And I was thinking too, in cross to judge, we have the exact same equipment. Yeah. Everything's the same except the rider.
And at the moment, our fitness, our weight, we're damn near the same rider.
I know we are. What's your FTP right now?
It's right around 300, 310 maybe.
So you're higher than me. I'm 290 today. I'm doing my last workout as 290. I'm going to do a big, I should probably talk about this.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's step back a second.
Let's cover it.
You know, I broke, everyone knows, hopefully, I broke my collarbone. I went from, I think, 300 or 310 down to 275 and then did one hard day, one easy day, day off. One hard day, one easy day, one off. And I would just pick workouts from either Sweet Sweat Base 2 or build, general build, and I'd just pick a, that would be my hard workout. And then I usually do Baxter as the easy workout or Petit. So I have now, I self-assessed and went from 275 to 290.
Nice.
Went through, and now I feel that I am ready to go to my next jump, which is going to be 305.
Nice.
And, but I have a travel, I'm going, everyone, side note, people keep emailing in that all this travel stuff, Nate's always on vacation, blah, blah, blah. I think I took like 2 weeks with my family, I think last year. It's for work.
Sorry to interrupt, but somebody actually hashtag CEO life when one of their questions.
Yeah. So I am going to an intensive finance program for 4 days where I'm going to be in a room learning about finance because my CFO skills aren't to where I think they should be. For us. So I'm doing that and it's at Wharton. It's going to be cool, but it's going to be a lot of hard work. So during that time, I'm not going to be able to have access to a bike. And I think we go all day into the evening every day. But so what I'm going to do is I'm doing more stress today. I'm going to do a 2 or 2.5 hour ride, get a lot of stress. And I've been building up stress and being consistent leading up to this to have 4 days of no work to kind of recover. And then once I come back, I'm going to be at 305, probably do something like Ericsson or Huffaker. Mm-hmm. I kind of like starting a new higher FTP with a VO2 max workout. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to do, but it just like sets everything up right. It kind of like sets the tone of how hard things are going to be. So right now, Chad is stronger than me, but hopefully, just give me some time. I just need time. Someday he'll be too old. Did you say a lot of hope?
Nice dig. Nice subtle one thrown in there. That'll be an interesting one too, because there's a lot of single track and a lot of switchbacks on this one.
I'm horrible at switchbacks. So, can you write switchbacks?
I'm pretty good at switchbacks. Uphill or down.
I think Chad was actually horrible, but he just heard you say you were horrible. So now he says he's great. He's playing mind games.
I can do the whole thing where you lock the front wheel and pivot the bike around. And
I'm learning how to do that.
Yeah. You do that.
Okay. He's hot on your heels. Let's go to David's question. He says, "Hi, Trainer Roaders. Thanks for the podcast. I listen as soon as it's out. You're my vicarious contact with Serious Training. Hopefully we can help you get a direct contact with that. We just got our second child, meaning we have a newborn and an almost 2-year-old. Okay, now it makes sense. Yeah. Basically, a terrible combination for training. Can I ride 3 or so times a week indoors for an hour on my lunch break and still get fitter? I just can't imagine when I can ride for hours on the weekend in the coming year with family and work responsibilities. What about a plan sequence that I could follow? Base, build, and specialty. And that, for those that don't know, that's how we break down your season of training into 3 sequential phases like that. And just choose some shorter versions of the longer workouts, or is that defeating the purpose? I don't need to peak for any race this year, but want to be able to race next year. Thanks heaps, David."
Yeah, David, basically what you've described is our bread and butter. That's pretty much every low volume plan that's out there. It falls right around 3 hours. It might push a little above because the weekend workout is 90 minutes. So if you can maybe squeeze in that 90 minutes, you can follow these exactly as they are. If you can't, you can just trim that workout a little bit and there should be an existing 75 minute or 60 minute, sometimes 45 minute and even 30 minute version of the workouts you have on your schedule anyway. But the fact of the matter is that 3 times a week, as long as the workouts are the right types of workouts, you can absolutely get stronger and continue to do so over a pretty long stretch of time.
Yeah, just follow the base build specialty just like that.
Yep.
Pretty straightforward. And it sounds like you have the luxury to be able to fit it in at lunch at work, which is awesome to be able to have that, because once you get home, I mean, I know this, training at home is so difficult with little ones like that. So
yeah, it has to be before they get up or after they go to bed.
Right. It's really tough. And naps, naps just don't work. Yeah, you never know how long a nap is going to be. So it's just setting yourself up for potential disappointment. So sounds like you've got a good setup there, David. John, and this is getting back to what we were talking about earlier, is there any scientific evidence to back up that active recovery is more beneficial than complete rest? Do you have anything on this
chart? There is, and it typically revolves around basically lymph drainage. So when you sit around, the lymph system is not nearly as active as it is when the muscles are working. So just think of waste removal. That's really what it boils down to. And then, you know, the lymph system is responsible for a lot of things. But in particular, and I actually jotted down a couple things. It removes dead cells, proteins, excess interstitial fluid, bacteria, cancer cells, toxic metabolites, et cetera. The list goes on. The fact is, stuff you don't want in your system, that movement facilitates its removal via the lymph system.
Pretty straightforward. Yeah, and I think the active recovery is something that's really misunderstood. Coaching junior athletes, we really have to be very specific on active recovery.
Yep.
And so one of the ways that one of our coaches, Kyle Dixon, he's like a 7-time national champ. Justin.
Kyle, he races like twice a year, and one of them happens to be nationals, and he usually wins.
Yeah, he's awesome. So, and one of the things that he tells them, he says that this should be going around the corner to go get a Slurpee pace. And don't do it on the trails for mountain bikers.
That's what's key to this. Active recovery, keyword being recovery. The actives is not the part you concern yourself with. And if you do, you're very clear on the fact that active is not very active. It's just, it's light. Breathe through your nose. Completely.
You could tape your mouth shut.
I suppose you could.
I remember one of the kids telling us, he said, it was active recovery. I was descending the whole time.
And no,
that's not active recovery.
No, we're talking restful. You know, you should feel that you're, you know, healing. And then next time you get on the bike, you're actually ready to get on the bike again. You don't feel like, man, I'm still tired from that last workout because I didn't recover effectively enough in between.
Right.
I've got a question to answer. We said this 3 podcasts ago that we were going to talk about vitamin D absorption.
Oh, we did.
We forget over and over and over and over again.
That's why you're busy at work over there.
That's my bad. I needed to be better at that. Sorry.
Yeah, Jonathan, it's your fault.
It is.
Just kidding. It was not Jonathan's fault. I said it and I was supposed to look it up and I didn't. Vitamin D does get absorbed through your skin, but there are some things that could slow it down. One, I didn't know about the latitude of where you live. If you live more like very north or very south with low sun angles, you might not get as much vitamin D than if you live by the equator.
Makes sense.
Is one quick question. I don't know if you know this.
Probably don't.
Okay. But is that just because of the fact that there is less, I guess the sun is up in the sky less time, or is it really because of the angle of the light coming down?
Less UVB light is penetrating through the atmosphere.
Gotcha. Mm. Okay. So yeah, so it's not about just like more direct sun on more of your skin, but it's actually, okay, interesting, cool.
The air pollution where you live, so if there's a lot of air pollution, that could also stop the UVB rays from hitting your skin, which is what raises your vitamin D levels. Sunscreen could also stop it, but the article that I'm getting this information from is health.harvard.edu. If you put most people don't put enough sunscreen on, they say, to actually block it. So they say if you put on a ton, you might do it, but most people don't put on enough.
I wonder if like spray versus spread on would change that too, you know?
I do not know.
Your spread on sunscreen tends to be so thick and kind of cover the surface, whereas spray
makes it easier to gob it on.
Right, yeah. Sorry, coming up with these questions, and I know we don't have answers to them, but I assume people are probably thinking the same thing. So
this article says, your weight, fat tissue sops up vitamin D. So it's been proposed that it might be a vitamin D rainy day fund, a source of the vitamin when intake is low or production is reduced. But studies have also shown that being obese is correlated with low vitamin D levels, and that being overweight may affect the bioavailability of vitamin D. So that's kind of saying both sides, that if you're overweight, you'll get more, but there's a correlation of being obese is that you don't have as much.
Is that why you had a deficiency? Because you were so fat.
Ouch.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm going to go cry.
That's interesting. So maybe more surface area, so you have more to collect, but then you're maybe not as good as processing it.
I think it said the actual, like the fat tissue absorbs it better. Also, it says the temperature of your skin, your age, and you could have, if you had problems with your liver or your kidneys, you could also not absorb it as well.
Interesting.
But so there you go. It doesn't mention anything about wearing sunglasses not having you That was the original thing that brought this up, is I wasn't sure that if you wore sunglasses that blocked UVB, if you would, that would somehow inhibit your vitamin D absorption. Right. And according to this Harvard article, it does not.
It does not.
Well, it doesn't mention it. It doesn't mention it. That's a difference.
Right, yeah. Interesting. Thank you,
good
Nate.
Good stuff.
Yeah, that was good.
I just read an article.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I sounded smart.
And we cited it, so that's important. Chris, this one's really fun. I actually like this. And I don't know, this is a new format to racing for a lot of people. So first of all, let's cover this. If anybody hasn't heard of Manual for Speed, you can go to manualforspeed.com. It's a quirky and fun take on race coverage, and it's pretty fun stuff. Emiliano and the crew over there are good people. Anyways, this involves them. You'll see. Chris says, "Hi guys, 5 stars on the podcast. I've been listening for a year or so now and using Trainer Road for a while longer. Since November, I've completed the majority of my training indoors, more than 120 rides on the trainer, including the endurance rides." Nice job, man. That's good. "Progressing from sweet spot base through the criterium specialty phase, which I am halfway through now. As a member of the Manual for Speed's Amateur Animal Cycling Club, I will be competing in the scheduled," and he says in quotes, "knife fights throughout the season in several different criteriums across the country." And you can read more about those at manualforspeed.com. I'm going to describe that really quick, what it is. So basically, once again, it's a quirky, fun website, and this whole process is kind of quirky and fun. And they say, "The strongest rider doesn't always win every bike race, and we think that sucks. So we're coming up with a way for the strongest rider to win a race within a race." And basically, you have to be a Cat 3 rider, because they say this isn't really a Cat 2 or Cat 1 thing. It's more of a Cat 3 thing. And they say you have to show up, and you have to have their socks to be eligible to win. And if you do this, and you throw more punches, and what I mean by that is you go off the front and disrupt the pace of the race more, or string things out, or get on a breakaway, whoever throws more punches in a race wins. I'm not really sure what they win, but they win something. So it's kind of a fun way to just throw some chaos into a race in terms of pace, not safety or anything, but in terms of pace. And it's just at select criteriums throughout the year. I think there's like 7 or so. So Boise Twilight, Tulsa Tough, a few of the bigger ones like that. So that's what it's all about. That's what this whole knife fights thing is. So he says, "Any Cat 3 racers are welcome to join with us by following the application process, which is basically buying a pair of socks and showing up at the race. Part of my approach, in contrast to my two teammates who are training old school, has been to use Trainer Road to be as specific and efficient as possible in my training. My program will be completed a week or so before the first knife fight, which is being held at Tulsa Tough. Subsequent knife fights will occur at Boise Twilight, the Manhattan Beach Grand Prix, and Gateway Cup in St. Louis, and then the Mayor's Cup in Boston. The primary fitness element needed for success in these events is to be able to attack repeatedly throughout the criteriums per knife fight rules. With that being the case, how might I approach selecting my programming after Tulsa Tough so that I am able to be as prepared as possible for these events, which are evenly spread throughout the racing season? Counting on you guys, Chris the Cheetah."
Sounds to me like it's a perfect fit for the criterium specialty plan. I mean, that's basically what a criterium is. You can ride a criterium and kind of hide in the pack and wait for the final sprint, but that's not really how I've designed that training plan. I don't try to cultivate riders who are effectively lazy. I like people to be active, to animate races, and be players and not just viewers, so to speak. So that I work through sweet spot base 1 and 2, and then onto the general build, and then, depending on, if you want to bypass those because your fitness is already there, then just dive right into that criterium specialty plan. But if you look at the format of the workouts, they're very much what you're describing right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kind of thing you're looking for, if you look at the picture of the workout, it's a bunch of spiky things.
Yes.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Lots of spikies, not slow, flat ones, or not long and flat. It's a lot of skinny up and down. And sometimes, even with, I looked at one, I forget the name of it now, but it was so spiky that in the thumbnail version of it, there weren't enough pixels to make it go. So it just looked like there was a giant block at like 180% FTP. It was like 10 seconds on, 10 seconds off for like 15 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But those are you want spiky.
Yeah. And what we talked about when we're talking about cyclocross last episode, when we're talking about the type of efforts that have you going far above FTP, then settling back in at or around FTP, and then doing it over and over and over again, you'll encounter a lot of that in the criterium plan. Similar stuff in the cyclocross plan, you'll see as well, those similar type of workouts. And it really pays off, and you can be such a thorn in the side of a race.
It's so much more fun too.
Oh, it's awesome. It's a ton of fun. So I approve of these knife fights. The one thing that I guess he's covering here is, let's say he has time and he finishes the specialty plan for Tulsa Tough, right? What does he do then in between then and the next race? Would he want to, and obviously the time frame in between these races will vary.
Check that, yeah.
I think that Boise is just after the 4th of July, I believe. It's like the next week or somewhere right around there. It's always right around that time frame, I think. So, but if they do that, would you recommend, what would he do in between specialty plans if he had some time to gap that out?
What type of gap are we talking about?
Well, let's, I guess, talk just from a principal perspective. After the race, is he going to want to take like a week and just like do some easy stuff to recover, then get back into his specialty plan?
Yeah, anytime you're coming off of a long stretch that includes a fair amount of high intensity training, it's not a bad idea to just dial things down and let your autonomic system and endocrine system and those things that have been out of whack for so long and have been so stressed to normalize. If you've got the time, it's not a bad idea. If you don't have the time, I feel like you should make time. And then if the duration is shorter, you can just use those, the taper weeks. So all the specialty plans, weeks 7 and 8 are really good. Trim down, you know, just enough stress to keep you sharp, but not enough to make you tired so that you can hopefully carry your fitness and freshness into either your race weekends or even your midweek stuff.
What if it's 6 weeks?
Yeah, 6 weeks, I would probably take the 1, maybe 2 weeks, depending on how much, you know, stress you carried into or out of the end of your specialty phase in racing. And then fill that other 4 weeks with perhaps the first 4 weeks of the specialty plan, or maybe even the latter 4 weeks of the specialty plan, so that you're right back into that taper and race structure.
Hmm. Great.
Yeah, that's what I would do too. Good luck, Chris, at the knife fights. That'll be interesting to see. I'm excited. And hopefully hopefully you're in some Manual for Speed coverage. That would be funny to see too. I would like that. So Matt, I'm currently on general build mid volume. I can handle more TSS on weekends. Can I swap the high volume weekends into the mid volume plan? If it is not the TSS of high volume per se that deters me, or he says it is not the TSS of high volume per se that deters me, but the weekday workout length. My wife and I work out in mornings, so already a 5 a.m. wake up at the latest for an hour workout is pretty tough. We have more time on the weekends, and I think I could handle the TSS, but it appears that the workouts on the high volume plan are different in nature on any given weekend and maybe should not be swapped straight across.
Yeah, Matt, this is exactly why I created all those shorter versions, because it's just really hard to get in a 90-minute and sometimes even a 75-minute. I mean, it's hard enough to get 60 minutes in before work. It often comes at the expense of sleep, which is the last thing I want, but you got to do what you got to do. They don't carry straight across, but the fact is you can deal with more volume and you can handle more stress, and the workouts will be similar enough in nature that I think you'll notice if there's direct overlap. If you're basically repeating your Tuesday workout, just a longer version of it, you can use some common sense and say, I'm going to do something mildly different. You know, instead of VO2 max, I'm going to do over-unders. So you can make those calls, but pretty much you're not going to do yourself any harm by swapping them around. And as far as the training benefit, you're not going to go, you can't do that poorly.
Hmm. Awesome. John's question. He says, I really enjoy your podcast. I anxiously await the new podcast each week. 5 stars, definitely. I recently put a SRAM Quark power meter on my mountain bike. I can see the benefits of using it for training, specifically in doing intervals and tracking my progress on segments that I ride often. I plan on doing 3 to 4 long distance mountain bike races, 50 miles or more. So this guy's eyeing the same races that we're doing. He's eyeing that we might line up against him in the Carson City off-road.
He said he's Whiskey off-road and Carson City off-road. We need to meet John.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Do we know John's last name?
I don't have to share it, but get your contact info. When you're here, it'd be cool. Actually, you should come by Trainer Road HQ. It's about 30 minutes away from race start there in Carson. It's really not a far drive. So up into South Reno, it'd be fun. So yeah. And that goes, I guess, for anybody coming to Carson City off-road that's going to race it. Shoot us an email. Let us know if you want to come check it out.
You can have a pizza party.
That'd be awesome. Good times.
50% carbs, 25% protein, 25% fat.
That makes a pizza party very not fun anymore when we break down the macros. He says, I use a Garmin 920 XT synced to my power meter. On race day, which power metrics, average power, power, normalized power, or cadence, should I be following during the race to make sure I am pushing myself hard enough or not too hard to optimize my effort for the race? I have used heart rate prior to having the power meter. Does Jonathan use a power meter during his mountain bike races? And if so, what does he track during the race?
That's a great question because this is an endurance race, which is different. We've talked about this a lot for cross country about ignore it.
Yeah.
But this one, long, at least the Carson City, long climb to start out with, pacing's going to matter.
Yes.
So Jonathan, what are you going to do? I'm going to say what I'm going
to
do.
Yeah, so just to touch on what you said before, I don't look at my power meter during an XC race in any terms of pacing. I'll look at it afterward, but I try to not even look at it during the race because you're constantly going so high. You don't want to freak yourself out. With this race, on the other hand, I'm going to be keeping my eye on my normalized power for that race. I want to make sure that I am sitting in a position halfway into that race. I don't want to be in a situation, because it's going to be like a 5-hour day at least, you know, 5 to 6 hour day. For fast guys, and it could be longer, you know, for other people.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
I wasn't thinking of you specifically.
But you were. You're looking at Chad, then you said, and it might be, and you looked over at me.
I apologize. It wasn't intended that way. But some people, I think last year, I could be wrong, but I remember, and the course will be different like we've covered, but this could only make it longer perhaps because you're going to have more, I think you'll have just like more steeper climbing, so you'll have some slower stuff in this, but I think that there were a lot of like 7 hour finishes on that 50 mile ride, which 50 miles on a mountain bike, for anybody that hasn't done 50 miles on a mountain bike and not just on a fire road, that's a long day, man. You are really tired after that. So if it's that long, I want to get into that thing halfway through and I don't want to see myself above, you know, 78 or 0.78 IF, anything like that. So around 78% of my threshold. Because if I'm going to crack,
that'd be pretty high for 5 hours. Yeah,
exactly. That's why I say I don't want to see myself any higher than that. If I'm doing that, I'm pretty much, I know that I'm going to have a bad race later on or bad second half. So I want to be below that, which is really hard with mountain biking. Last year, this race, it didn't matter quite as much in terms of getting a fast start, which mountain biking traditionally starts hard because you funnel into single track and you have to have good positioning. If you're stuck behind slow people, it can cost you a ton of time that you simply can't make up. But last year, it was just a long road and then a long fire road for an hour and 40 minutes of climbing. So it didn't matter your positioning. This year, I think you're going to funnel into single track really quickly.
Oh, no.
So it will change. So if that's the case, you're going to have a harder start, but you'll still want to be looking, at least for me, I'm going to be looking at normalized power. The other thing I'll be looking at on a long ride like this is my kilojoules and how many I am expending, just to make sure that just in the heat of a moment in a race, and especially technical terrain on a mountain bike, sometimes you will forget to eat, forget to do anything like that. And you have to remind yourself on a long day like that.
So I'm going to break that down for a second. On a mountain bike, on a race like this, when do I eat? Because it's technical and I got to, and where do I carry it? Is it in my jersey pocket like I would on a road race or?
Yeah, I'm jersey pockets. Some people bring a Camelback on long rides like this, but Epic Rides does a really good job of making sure there are aid stations in good spots. So it's not like you don't have, you know, support cars roving around. You can't do that, but they have scheduled aid stations actually all around the course.
Aid stations meaning feed also?
Probably just have water at those races. You are, I think, responsible for carrying your own food.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but it's always a safe assumption to make sure you do that.
One thing about our Chad and my bike, the 4.5, it doesn't have room for a bottle inside the triangle.
Right.
It's really down low and I have problems reaching it from how tall I am.
Might be the way to go.
Yeah.
What'd you say, Chad?
Camelback might be the way to go. That or a bottle in the pocket.
I was going
to
do a Camelback back with some kind of sugary liquid inside.
Smart.
And then for food, though, I guess in jersey pockets, because I don't want to like stop, take my backpack off.
Yeah.
I can't reach into it while I'm racing.
I would do jersey pockets for sure on the food. And in terms of hydration, a Camelback really isn't a bad idea on a long day like this, too, because I mean, you get to an aid station and you're grabbing cups, let's say. I don't know if they'll have bottles or cups, but you grab a cup. And if you grab that cup and you bobble, then you drop all the water out of it. There you go. And if you have a Camelback, chances are you have more fluid that you can hold in there, so you can save some reserve. But with a bottle, you're probably going through them pretty quick.
Yeah, the downside of a Camelback would obviously be that extra weight. Mm-hmm. And if I'm carrying 2 liters of water, that's a lot of extra weight.
A lot of weight.
But... And also, you start going really slow if you get dehydrated.
Yes.
Right? Like exactly. Way more than the weight loss.
Yeah. And my concern with the Camelback is always bike handling. And I could get used to that. and I probably should, right? I could get used to that, but I always never have a Camelback on. It really does change where your weight is, you know, centered. And also depending on the bag you have, it can really jostle around, and that's terrifying. If you like go over a little drop or something that's really benign and not scary, it's just like a foot or two, something like that. If you have a little, like a little monkey jumping on your head from your back when you're doing that, it gets really scary. So that's something that you'll want to look for if you do have a bag, is something that really stays put, something that, it doesn't just jostle around on you.
So I'm going to talk to you about my strategy now with this Carson City Off-Road with the power meter, three laps, 50 miles.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to pre-ride the course, I think, and hopefully I can later with you later.
That'd be great.
But if it does have the, let's say we go into single track early, based on my previous experience, a lot of people sprint who have no business sprinting because they have no fitness on the long climb. So I need to, one, sprint like really hard at the beginning. And then two, on this first single track, if there's any early on double track or anything where I can pass people, that first climb, I'm not going to look at my power meter and almost go all out, because I know once it starts to level off and after that, it is going to be single track with not a lot of passing opportunities. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. And I believe how this will work is we'll be in city streets at the very beginning. It will jump right off into single track, and then we'll end up being there for a few miles, and then we'll end up going on to a wider dirt road again for a while that's really steep. Kings Canyon.
Oh, so that wider dirt road might be a part where I could pass a lot of people.
Yeah, it's really steep. So, and it's probably pretty torn up, the terrain. So you'll want to, you know, be choosy on line choice. It won't, probably won't just be whoever has the most power can suddenly pass somebody. You'll have to have a combination of some strategy there. But yes, that's another opportunity to pass them. After that, it's a really long section of single track.
Like really long, right?
And they're not really like long.
No opportunities to pass, really.
No, yeah. I think it'll be probably about 14 miles of single track, which once again, for roadies, that probably doesn't sound like a lot. For mountain bikers, 14 miles of contiguous single track is a lot. So it's hard to come across.
Yeah. So then my next lap, what I would do is while I climb, I'd probably stay below 90% FTP, maybe 85, especially in those long climbs. I think of it like Iserman when I was pacing that. I think I, you know, my FTP I put in at 300 or 310. I keep forgetting. Let's just say 310 because that sounds better.
That sounds better, yeah.
And I kept the best bike split said nothing over 270 because you had a long day, kind of as long as this day will probably be.
Right.
And I'm not going to, as the second lap, the positions will, everything will be strung out, right? So I'm not going to be so concerned about the position.
Yeah.
But I don't want to make sure on my second lap I'm going over threshold that much, because that will then really hurt me on the third lap.
Yeah.
And I could lose a lot of time.
Which is really tough with mountain biking, to not go over threshold just because of the terrain, right? It's constant undulations and tough things where it requires you to put out little spikes over threshold.
But so probably for Chad, it's best if he tries to do VO2 max up that each climb, right?
I think that's probably best.
Try to hold it for about...
pretty much how I roll.
Yeah. Hour, 2 hours at a time. You can do it.
Just go as hard as I can, then I blow up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Please do that.
Also with, with this race, and we got derailed, or we derailed, I guess, a bit into the specifics of the race, but with this one too, you aren't going to have a lot of shade. It's a lot of open to the sun stuff. The region where the trail, a lot of the single track goes, it burned a number of years back. So it's pretty exposed.
That's a concern when it comes to putting a sugared drink in a Camelback.
It is.
It's just going to get bombed with sunlight and get hot.
No. You can do what you want. I'm giving Chad tips now. I kind of just, I didn't realize that this could be the first like Chad versus Nate. And it'll probably beat me by like 90 minutes, but the drama on the podcast is...
the drama in Nate's head.
Yeah, exactly. Chad has no like worries about the competition or anything. But I've gone in this area for a long time and just put ice in it.
Yeah.
The ice works. Does
it, I don't know how insulated Camelbacks are. I don't use them very often. I just know when you put ice in a bottle, it lasts all of 5 minutes on a
bottle. No. It works well. And you can fill 2 liters with ice, put the water in and the sugary drink, and it'll be a little more concentrated at first, but it'll be fine.
You can also get an insulated hose cover for your Camelback hose, which is nice.
Oh, those are really nice. Describe what those do.
Yeah, so basically it's like a neoprene sleeve. I think it's neoprene. That's what it feels like. And it basically just surrounds the hose, because that's one of the biggest problems is you drink and your Camelback hose goes from the shoulder strap of your bag, and then it hangs down onto your chest usually. So that little section right there is just like boiling hot tea that you have to drink first before you
every
get the
time,
cold.
Your first gulp every time.
It's gross. Yeah. and so that insulates it, but you can also get a sleeve that your Camelback sits in. It's made of the same material and that can help with insulating it as well. Certain bags, I think Camelback's newer bags have this, but certain bags actually have like insulated material surrounding where the Camelback fits, the reservoir fits inside. So
okay,
the insulated covering, that's not very cool.
No, right? It's it's like nerdy, sure, but man, if we're talking about a potentially, you know, 7 hour day on a good time and it might be longer, better to be nerdy and not foolish.
I've had hot tea like yellow Gatorade and it's the lemon lime. It's gross every time.
So gross.
The other benefit of doing the Camelback is I can put a bunch of tools in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so 50 miles, you know, you might have a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the aid stations, I believe that they have medics roving the course. They might have some medics at stations. And I know they also have mechanics at stations, which is really cool. Like they just go above and beyond for doing that stuff. But yeah, this is a long day. 50 miles on a mountain bike, a lot can go wrong on 50 miles on a mountain bike. So that's
smart.
Honestly,
I think if you're going to display anything on your power meter, I would almost take intensity factor over actual power output just to know that I'm not overdoing something I've got to hold on to for 5, 6, 8 hours.
That's a good point. It's kind of like a more stable metric to watch too that can freak you out a little less, maybe. Mm-hmm.
You can see both though. Because
I'm just saying, if I had to choose one, I might actually choose intensity factor.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. So that's what we'll be doing. And all of us will be riding with power there. So yeah, we'll have some data to compare. It'll be really good.
Who's going to put out the most power?
Chad.
Who's the second most?
You.
Yes. I just wanted you to say that.
And then me. Yeah. But I still think I'll win.
Well, you know,
between us three. I'm not going to win the race, but between us three.
So. You're lightweight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're not even in my radar yet. I got to beat Chad first.
I know those trails really well too. So I love that area. It's really good. Anyways, if anybody's coming up to Carson City Off-Road, let us know. We can plan something. It'd be fun. Frank, he says, as many have said, I love the podcast and I'm rolling through the back catalog on my compute like I roll through old series on Netflix on the trainer. I've heard a number of times your recommendations to backpedal 15 to 20 seconds as a method to break up the effort of a long sweet spot interval when you feel like you're going to break. And by break, he means that you can't continue.
Correct.
Yep. In erg mode, for those that don't know as well, a smart trainer that actually like holds you into your power target. Our app will adjust the resistance of that trainer so that you're always on target with whatever your target power is. In erg mode, how do you overcome the need to overcrank the resistance to get back up to speed after you've lost momentum? And we should probably describe what this feels like first, right?
Yeah. So I'll describe what happens is, you know, power is a function of how quickly, what your cadence is, and then how much torque you're putting on. So the erg trainer is trying to lock you in, let's say 300 watts. And when you're spinning at 90 RPM, it doesn't have to put much torque, like you don't have to have much torque coming. So it doesn't have to have much resistance on the trainer for that to happen. Now, every trainer, they all do this. Mm-hmm. I think everyone we've tested.
Yeah.
If you go down to like a really, if the rear flywheel starts to slow, and that's kind of analogous of how fast you're cranking, because the rear speed is really a function of your gearing and your cadence. When your rear flywheel slows down a ton, the trainer says, oh my gosh, for me to lock in at 300 watts, I have to put a ton of resistance on this thing. So what happens is you get really slow and you start to pedal, and it's like you can almost stand up on the pedals and it doesn't move.
Yeah.
Right. And I have always wanted trainer manufacturers to fix this in their own firmware. But we ended up no one did it. So we just did it ourselves. So on other trainers, if you wait and the rear wheel stops and you give it like 5 seconds, you can start doing it. We've done some math in there to figure out when this happens and we take off all the resistance. So if, as of this podcast, on all versions of Trainer Road, which this is Monday, May 8th, 2017. Mm-hmm. All versions of Trainer Road should have this fixed. And if you are still experiencing it, please send a support ticket to support@trainerroad.com and we will tune our algorithm to make sure so that it doesn't happen to you in your situation.
Yep. Awesome. And this is like, we referred to it a lot of the time, or you may have heard to it as the clench that you feel mm-hmm. with the smart trainers. Mm-hmm. And it can be pretty frustrating at times when you feel that, but this is a really good way to round it.
Yeah, you just have to basically anticipate it and kind of wind it up before you're going to take one of your breaks.
Yeah.
And it's just, you had to be very aware of what was going on, but I like our fix. It sounds pretty encouraging.
I'd always see it with beginner riders like my wife. They mm-hmm. get on it and they kind of slow down
cadence
their cadence.
Just goes down,
yep.
down.
And then it would slow down and they try to start again and they couldn't.
And it'd be so hard.
Yeah. And
it's someone, like really, really, really.
Like immovable in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
but someone like really strong like Chatterai, we could just push through the pedals. Where someone newer just gives up and then they get really confused and frustrated.
Yeah. And like starting out, like, or if you start out at like barely pedaling along, you know, you're like 30 RPM or something, the trainer's going to be like, holy cow, I mm-hmm. got to ramp up this resistance mm-hmm. To make sure, because once again, your speed, the leg speed that we're talking about is low. So,
and I don't think we will actually fix that solution. If you're at 30 right. RPM, it might still clench.
Right.
There's this line we have to walk of when are you really riding the trainer and when are you really just spinning down?
Yeah.
And if we were to have someone at 30 RPM and say you're not riding the trainer, someone who wants to do really low pedals or
low cadence.
That's what I'm talking about, is we need to tune this based on user feedback. I personally have not experienced one clench since it's gone in, and we keep track of what kind of tickets people are emailing us in, and we haven't had any tickets about this on a ride since someone's done this on the new version, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
Awesome.
It's good news, but again, please tell us if you're experiencing the problem or any problems, because we want to fix them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we're all about. Ray's question. He says, hi guys, I'm a 46-year-old triathlete in my second year of using Trainer Road, having only taken up any sports of any form 2.5 years ago. That's awesome, man. Just jumping straight into it. He says, I'm currently in the middle of half triathlon build low volume, and I'm 4 weeks out from my first 70.3 of the year. This is only a B race. My A races being another 70.3 in July and a full Ironman in September. My query is this. I have just discovered road time trialing. I did my first 10-mile TT a couple of weeks ago and managed a fairly respectable 24 minutes and 23 seconds. These will take place weekly throughout the summer very close to my home. Are these a good bonus addition to my weekly training load, and will they have a beneficial effect on my overall FTP and endurance fitness? Should I swap them out with another workout from the plan, or keep them as an additional session? So let's leave it at that, because he's got another question that we'll address, which will be fun in just a bit. But
that's a pretty straightforward muscle endurance workout. So it carries really well to improving endurance fitness for sure. Could affect FTP. Chances are for that duration, you're riding right around FTP. So it's really more going to be focused on the amount of time you can sustain FTP. Not as much lifting it, but it can have a positive effect on FTP as well. I don't know that I would add it on top of everything. You might trade it for something that's similar in nature. And it strikes me as a really good opportunity to assess FTP, because it's a 25-minute effort and you're going to try to be as fast and as steady as possible. So I think it's an excellent opportunity to get a feel for on a weekly basis where your FTP is.
Yeah, really good thinking. We don't have I know in the UK, 10-mile time trials are really big. So mm-hmm. I don't know if that's where you're from, Ray.
I think so. We don't see them over here.
A whole lot here.
No, it's 40K or nothing, man.
We have hill climb time trials and the occasional time trial here, but we don't have like a time trial, just, you know, a series like that. He then says, I hear you guys planning your race seasons in different disciplines. How about a time trial? It's the race of truth after all. Who do you think would be the fastest?
Oh, I so want to do this, because this is...
Oh, let's absolutely do this.
Yes, let's do this, because Chad and I are staring at Jonathan, because this is our chance.
Yeah, yeah, I'm like meat on this one. I'm just, yeah, I'm roadkill.
He doesn't even own a TT bike, but we said you could borrow Dave Christensen's bike.
Which I'd probably fit on pretty well.
Exactly.
I'd be a little tall for it, but I'm sure I'd fit on.
I've got a Neopride frame just sitting in my office.
Yeah, you do.
Just needs a home.
Yeah.
So if we, I mean, see, we already missed Sally. I think next year... Sally 40K TT?
Well, we miss it for Jonathan. You and I could probably rally, make it work. Wouldn't be particularly impressive, but we could do it.
I can't. My.
Right. Yeah, with your collarbone. That'd be bad in aerial position like that.
All right,
the whole
Sally 2018.
Yep.
All right.
Us versus Jonathan. This is my chance.
Us versus Jonathan.
For Loyalton or wherever it is, but out there. District TT.
Yeah, you guys will probably. I mean, here's the interesting thing, though. I think that I have sold myself short in all the time trials I've done before
in
two key areas. Number one, I think more of a, well, maybe not more of a limiter, but I think the biggest limiter has been my mentality going into those events. I've told myself that I'm not a good time trialist, and I've never enjoyed naturally just long sustained efforts. But like I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, I actually have found just a lot of power in being able to change my mentality, not literal power, that's a poor use of word, but in my ability to change my perception, approach, and just mental condition about long, steady efforts. And I think that I was really selling myself short there. On the other hand, too, equipment, and that does make a huge difference in a TT, of course, but I really think that if I did have that down on the calendar, I think that I could actually do decently well. But I really don't know if I could beat you guys. I mean, you're bigger guys.
I don't want to discourage you.
I'm sure you can't.
Jonathan, I'm sure you could. And I think you could just jump on the bike on race day and beat us without even trying, without even practicing on the TT bike.
So that's the approach I should take?
Yep. And don't worry about the equipment advantage that Chad and I have.
Okay.
I mean, you can borrow equipment.
It's of no consequence.
Borrow equipment from Dave.
Cross bike would be good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dave Christensen, who is he rides internationally as a pro.
Yes.
A great time trialist.
Yes.
He has all the equipment you need.
Yeah. And Dave would be happy to lend it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Especially if you beat us.
Yeah. The one thing about time trialists, and this is a common, I guess, belief about time trialists, and probably a good opportunity for us to dispel it a bit. Bigger guys being better at time trials. And we're kind of talking
depends
about
on the
a
nature. Yeah, so
time
a flat time trial.
So
when you go uphill, you know, it's strength versus weight. But when you're on a flat road, it's more about strength versus aerodynamics.
Yep. Mm-hmm. What it's about.
So it's really, I mean, if a tiny little dude can be really aero, he may not have a lot of power, but if he's super aero mm-hmm. for the amount of power he's putting out.
And it comes down to, you know, position, which is a part of the aerodynamics. And then pacing becomes a very big deal when it comes to when it's dealing with a steady state event of this nature.
Yep. Mental fortitude.
Yes. Yep, that's a big one too.
Unfortunately, I have, although I am a small build, I have manly broad shoulders for my size. So that makes me less aero, but.
Where?
I was waiting for that. Thank you. Yeah, I teed that one up for you too.
There are ways to circumvent that too. I mean, even Tony Martin's got pretty broad shoulders. So is Fabian. They can get down. They scrunch back and they can make themselves just a little bit narrower.
Just to give myself an excuse, there is a correlation between CDA, which is your aerodynamic drag, and being taller. The taller is not good.
The negative correlation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not so much weight as in height. So me and Chad are the same weight, but I would have generally a higher aerodynamic drag.
He's a little taller. I wonder what our shoulders, how they stack up.
Yeah, I would think that Chad's shoulders are broader.
It's not based on shoulder width. Hmm. From what I've seen, they always talk about height, and I don't
interesting.
Exactly know why.
Well, I'm sure we'll delve pretty heavily into this.
I need to send myself to the wind tunnel.
If you're going, I'm going.
Everyone but Jonathan.
This will be interesting.
Pictures.
I actually would look forward to doing this. I don't think I could ever actually justify owning a time trial bike. Says me now. We'll see what happens in a year, right? But I don't know if I could ever justify having one and doing just the time trial. But, you know, I'm probably... I could see myself actually enjoying this. So this could be good.
It's down.
Sounds fun.
All right, cool. Next year. And let's go into the last question for today. This one's from Alan. He says, hi guys, after a race or a hard training session, what is the best way to warm down? Which zone should you be in? How long do you warm down for? Is there a train road session I could use? And what's the risk with not warming down correctly or at all? Keep up the great work. Love the podcast and software. This one's kind of a tricky one. So there are a lot of different theories. And in fact, every pro team like 3 years ago was warming down after every stage. Now, not as many pro teams are warming down.
There's like a big push for normalizing your autonomic system, right? Your fight or flight system, bringing that thing back down. And I know that can certainly carry to the quality of sleep should you work out late at night. Mm-hmm. That's when I'm a big proponent of cool downs. As far as outside of that, I haven't seen what the science is. It might be out there, but I haven't come by it.
Yeah. I haven't seen the study, but I've seen someone reference in an article that cooling down or warming down helps you in your next workout to go harder. Like it helps aids in recovery, but yeah. It's tough to.
Yeah, everything I read is all vague like that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not terribly useful.
Yeah, and I've read the same thing, and then of course we've all heard the many things like warming down doesn't stops you from getting DOMS and delayed onset muscle soreness.
No, that's not true.
Lactate clearance, no, that's
not
takes
true.
Place anyway.
Yeah, so there, and I think there are a lot of misconceptions about it. That's and the pro Peloton is not always an example of doing the best thing necessarily. There's a lot of dogma in place. There's a lot of, you know, tradition or anything else like that.
It's really hard to refute anything Sky does. I mean, they make everything work so well. So when they do something, it gets people's attention. But whether or not there's validity to this, I don't know.
It's tricky.
People used to say that about other teams too. And they found out, not saying that Sky does anything, but you know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean with that, though.
Some things could happen that you don't know about behind the scenes.
Warming down.
Correlation is not causation. That's my point on that.
True.
Jonathan, why don't we assign Coach Chad to do some research on this?
I like it. And then we can talk about it next episode.
Sure.
I'll mark it down so then we don't forget it, like the vitamin D stuff.
Okay.
And something else along the lines, just with warming down. So personally, the only time that after a criterium or something like that, if it's like a local crit, I'll spend a short amount of time noodling around, but that's usually just for the social aspect. Mm-hmm. I like to recap the race and we call it bench racing in the motocross world, but kind of just relive the race a bit with friends. When I'm mountain biking though, I do like to, I go a little bit more monk when I'm mountain bike racing. And after the races, I do like to spend a little bit of time riding, but it's purely an emotional or psychological thing.
I do find it's a lot easier to get to bed after a later workout or a mm-hmm. Tuesday night crit or something like that.
Yeah. Having a little bit of time to, and once again, for me, I find most of the benefits. I don't know if there are physical benefits, but I do feel a psychological benefit for me when I'm able to do that. Also really helps to, in that moment, right after the race, kind of, if you're upset after the race, talk yourself down off the ledge a bit. If you are perhaps, you know, after that race also, like, sit back and look at it and analyze yourself and be honest with yourself right then when it's fresh. That's a really good thing to do.
Because I care about Jonathan's well-being, Chad, for district time trials next year, you should do a real long cool down for Jonathan. It's because he's going to be upset after that race.
I don't know how I'll do, man. That's probably the least certain. Like, I will never go into an event with a lower amount of certainty, probably.
We should make that your first time trial.
We're 14 months out, so.
My first time trial.
Yeah, well, 15. I mean, I guess you could do.
I'll do like the local 13. Stuff. We'll have some local TTs before then.
That'll probably be enough to know if you're going to beat us or not.
Yeah.
Although sadly, we will have an advantage Chad and I because it is pancake flat.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the chase with Justin Rossi, that is the same course that Nationals 40K.
Similar.
And I think they've switched to Loyalton. I don't know if that's a permanent switch, but it's just as flat.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's just as flat and in the same valley. So there are subtle differences. I think there's less tree cover with the new one.
Yeah, Loyalton, yes.
So
there's no trees out there.
I might need a new TT bike because I don't know if my bike, it's a triathlon bike, is legal.
Oh, I don't think it is.
You can't use it.
Oh, cool. Sweet. New bike time.
I think, Specialized has had a wind tunnel for how long? And their new shit still hasn't come out yet. Yeah. So, and I know that you usually have your Specialized bike, so maybe they'll have a new shiv.
Yep. Here's hoping.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thanks for submitting your questions. You can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can even convince us to race each other in a year like that one question did. If you're going to Carson City Off-Road, shoot us a message, let us know, and we can connect that way. And we'll talk to y'all next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.